Welcome to the Sacred Changemakers podcast, where we dive deep into conversations that inspire meaningful change. This podcast is proudly brought to you by our Inner Circle community, the world's leading global community and mastermind for changemakers. Join us as we uncover powerful insights, essential tools, and effective strategies designed to help you succeed in business while making a profound impact in our world. Are you ready to transform your ideas into action? Visit sacredchangemakers.com and become a member today. Hey there, and welcome to another enriching episode of the Sacred Changemakers podcast. Now, today, we journey into the depths of inner practices and community building with our special guest, Ben Catt. Ben's a meditation teacher. He's a transformational coach and speaker. He's the author of The Way Home, Discovering the Hero's Journey to Wholeness at Midlife, a book that helps guide people on their inner journey in transition and at midlife. Ben helps people develop these vibrant inner lives to experience greater fulfillment, purpose, and connection in life and work and also relationships. He was an ordained minister for over a decade, teaches meditation in prison, and volunteers as a hospice companion. He lives in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, with his wife and three children. So I invite you to join me as I uncover the profound wisdom Ben has to offer from his experiences as a hospice companion, a chaplain, and a meditator working with inmates. We dive deeply into many threads that are alive for us as sacred changemakers, from a quest for wholeness to discussing the importance of facing our own mortality, shedding life's protective masks, and embracing midlife transitions, not as a crisis, but as an exciting call to adventure. Ben shares his personal story of reconnection and the small daily practices that have guided him towards authenticity, truth, and inner stillness. You'll hear how his integrative approach merges spiritual principles with coaching and hear accounts of how meditation is transforming lives in state prisons. This episode promises to guide you on your path to wholeness, offering really practical insights and inspiring stories to help you reconnect with your true self. So tune in and be prepared to embark on your hero's journey to wholeness. This is such a deeply inspiring conversation that will offer you so many gifts. So without further ado, let me introduce you to Ben Catt. Hey, Ben, welcome to the Sacred Changemakers podcast.
Jane, so good to be here. I'm really excited to have this conversation with you.
Oh, me too. You have a really interesting background and I can't wait to dig in. But before we do, you know, our audience have just heard your professional bio. So I'd love to go beneath the surface of that just a little bit and find out something about the real life human that lies beneath. Who's he?
Yeah, that's a lovely question. I mean, my mind first goes to the relationships that are the most significant in my life, which is I've been married for 20 years to my wife, Cherie, and I'm a father of three children who are essentially all teenagers. So life is really full right now, really rich, a lot of laughter, a lot of activity. I actually just got back yesterday from a quick weekend trip to New York City with my son. We did explore the city a little bit, but we actually went there to watch my youngest brother's three kids for the weekend while him and his wife were out of town. So my uncle identity feels really fresh right now. I had kids first in my family. So now that mine are a little bit older, it's a lot of fun to be able to play and snuggle and read stories to the little ones, my nieces and nephews, you know, separated, you know, a few years out from my own exhaustion as a parent of young children. So yeah, I think that captures a bit about who I am.
Oh, that's lovely. Just wait till you become a grandparent. It's even better, I tell you.
I'm excited about that. I don't want to get there too soon, but you know. No.
Exactly. Well, you know, the title of our conversation today is Your Hero's Journey to Wholeness. And I'd love to hear a little bit of the backstory, Ben, of, you know, what is it in your life that brought you to your life's work?
Yeah, so I would say that for about 20 years, really longer, I have been expressing a version of my calling. But with each passing year and as I undergo new experiences and discover more of who I am, that calling, that purpose gets refined. And I really look to a point, which is about 10 years ago. I was living in Seattle at the time with my wife. We had three young children. I looked at this one point as really a pivotal moment in my life. I was out for early morning run in the rain, Seattle rain, and I ran around this little lake, and then typically I charge up this hill and sprint the last 10 blocks to my house. But on this one particular morning, I got to the top of the hill and I just stopped in my tracks. And as this voice welled up inside of me, and the voice said, "If you don't have your heart, you have nothing. If you don't have your heart, you have nothing." And right away, I knew that it was a wake-up call. It was an invitation, and on the surface, it signaled burnout. But there was much more beneath that. So I had been involved for a number of years at that point, probably almost 10 years, as an ordained minister. So I was pastoring a local community, doing community work, ran a community center, helping all sorts of folks dealing with mental illness and homelessness and substance addiction, and was doing really meaningful, purposeful work and working with wonderful friends, fostering community and belonging and all these things that I really cared about. And yet, somewhere along the way in that work, even as I was helping people, in a sense, like get their hearts back, I had lost my own. And so that morning began really a new season of my own journey, which I would say was towards wholeness, towards home, towards getting my heart back. And there's continuity between that version of myself and sort of how I express my purpose now. But that was absolutely a transformative moment. As you know, I think we all have. We have these different chapters and different phases. And it's important to allow ourselves to leave behind what's familiar, step into the unknown in order to embrace what's ahead for us.
And you're giving voice to something that I think we don't talk a lot about as, I'm going to say, change makers. When we're doing this purpose-driven work, when we are following our calling and on one level feeling really fulfilled, I do think it's easier. So I'm going to say easier to kind of lose yourself in that relationship with work than perhaps it is when you're just working, for corporate America or something, or a large global organization and just playing your part, because it means so much on one level to do that. Could you speak to that in a way? Because I feel this is an important point here for our audience to hear.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So I often will lead mindfulness and well-being workshops in corporate settings and nonprofit settings. And one of the things I always share there is there's a recent study that came out from Deloitte that highlighted things about burnout, about stress that would not surprise us, meaning things like, hey, there's no boundaries to burnout. Like if you're burned out in your work, it's going to have an impact on your relationships, right? It's going to follow you. Or the fact that if you're stressed and overwhelmed, it's going to negatively impact the quality of your work. But one thing that's always surprising for people that I think is really important to share is that passion is not preventative in burnout. And I think it's something like 60 to 70% of people, even if they love their job, they're making a positive impact. They love getting out of bed and going to work every morning, or going about the things that they feel called to, they might still become too stressed out and be carrying on in an unsustainable way and crash and burn, which is what happened to me. So it's really important to remember that, and because once you're going after something, especially when you're trying to be a change maker, you're trying to help other people, sometimes the good thing that we're pursuing, we end up doing something that negatively impacts us. We lose our sense of self. Ultimately, a lesser version of ourself then shows up, which means there's a way in which we're showing up in our relationships, in our work, say the organizations we're in or we're running, that is working against the bigger thing that we're about, right? So the simple example would be like, I'm about world peace or something. But now, because I'm exhausted, because I'm burned out, I'm stressed and overwhelmed in all my day-to-day relationships, I am not a peacemaker. I'm actually stirring up conflict everywhere I go. So, yeah, this is a really critical thing that if we want to see our society transformed, if we want to see our communities changed, I I really believe where it starts as we need to be tending to our own hearts and be sort of wholehearted people who prioritize our own well-being. And then that goodness, that life will radiate out from us into the spaces that surround us.
I mean, just listening to you there, it makes perfect sense. And I know that, a lot of your work emphasizes the importance of developing this vibrant kind of inner life, right? But what, practically speaking, what practices or habits do you recommend for individuals if they're looking to deepen that inner journey, that inner relationship with, let's say, their true selves?
Yeah. Oh, I love that. And that, 'cause I love how you landed that question about reconnecting with your true self, which can sound really lofty and abstract even, but what you're doing there is you're landing it in the daily life, in what's practical, in practice. And this is something I talk about a lot in my book, The Way Home, because from, that moment, that rainy morning run, if you don't have your heart, you have nothing. What really began was what came out of that is I had to figure out, okay, this is not sustainable. I can't keep moving forward like this. So, what's a new way that I can relate to my life? What's a new way that I can move through the world? And of course, it started with a bunch of small steps. And really, the first one was that day, I got home from the run. I like crawled into bed and I was like covered in rain and like sweat. And I was like, I want to hide in a cave. I don't want to do anything. Well, I canceled all my meetings that day. I had one thing on the calendar though that my wife's like, you should keep that. This was very wise advice. So already right there, I had my first intervention of help, which is always comes to us on this journey, this hero's journey, this becoming discovering our true self as help comes. So as practice actually is receiving that. But she said, keep this one meeting, and it was with a mentor of mine. We went out to lunch, and he kind of reminded me, hey, listen to me, let me like kind of share all this stuff and my discovery of my exhaustion. He's like, you know what? You're actually more buoyant than you think, meaning you've got some resilience here. You need to face this. You need to work through this stuff, and you're going to be okay, which was what I needed to hear. The next thing he did is right after we ate, he bought me, he went into the store and he bought me a journal, and he said, you need to start writing this stuff down. Now I'd had a journaling practice for years and years, but somewhere along the way, it shifted from what I think the best kind of journaling practices, which would be going inward, self-reflection, self-examination, reconnecting with that inner sense of self. But it shifted from that inward focus to forward focus, meaning, what am I going to do next? What am I going to accomplish? What am I going to achieve? All the ideas of what's out ahead of me, which then disconnected me from the present moment. So journaling, and again, I give that general guidance, but really it just is starting with simple reflection. That's a core practice. But also along the way, and I could talk about all these, meditation is my game-changing practice that helps me really stabilize really my nervous system, but also my awareness in daily life, and makes me extremely adaptive as changes come, which by the way is always happening. Wandering in nature or nature walks, these are really important practices too. So they actually there's a lot of noise out there about the practice, well-being practices, and then also steep price tags on a lot of these things. But in reality, some of the core ones of like being still and being in nature and journaling, I mean, these things are we can do these on our own all the time, low cost. And we can even like microdose these forms of solitude. You don't need to go away for months at a time. You can find a simple window of 10 minutes, get away from your computer, go for a walk. And by starting with those small things, we'll eventually start to make more space and grow our capacity. And this is what ends up happening, really grow our capacity to hear that inner voice that we've maybe been neglecting for too long.
I love that. I do. And there's, as I'm listening to you, I'm reflecting on my own life in a way. And I'm also a meditator. I've been doing it now for, oh gosh, I don't know, since my early 20s. So it's a long time now. And I don't know how I would do life without it. I mean, there really is just, like you say, it helps me to process my emotions. It helps with my nervous system. It helps with my physicality. It helps me be more intentional about how I show up, not just what I'm doing, but who I'm being and becoming. And I love that intentionality in my life. However, our title today is Your Hero's Journey to Wholeness. And as a coach, I mean, I've been in human change and human potential now for over 3 decades. And I can tell you, I know what it feels like to be fragmented on the inside. I really know that space very well. I'm not sure I know what it feels like to be whole. And I wonder if that's just me or whether it's unobtainable in some way, because there are times in my life when I look back, Ben, when I think, actually, yeah, this feels whole. This feels more coherent now. And yet then something will happen. And it's like, oh, another layer of the onion.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So
Yes.
it's like, please speak to this wholeness piece, because I wonder if I'm beginning to believe it's going to take me a lifetime, and it's more about the journey than it is the destination, which again
Yes.
is like bumper sticker,
Yeah.
stuff. But
And so true. It's
what's
so true.
the sense of it?
Yeah. I mean, my mind's going in multiple directions right now. The first thing that I want to say is, so that title for this conversation is related to the subtitle of my book. So, book's The Way Home: Discovering the Hero's Journey to Wholeness at Midlife. And I interact with Joseph Campbell, the famous 20th century mythologist, with his hero's journey pattern. He talked about departure, initiation, and return, these three phases. And he had like 17 steps. And we're familiar with this stuff to some degree. I interact with that and I have like 10 steps. Now, I'm not going to go through them all, but the reason I'm bringing up in response to this question is because the 10th step is towards wholeness, as I'm talking about this pattern, is begin again. Meaning, yes, that
Love
this
it.
is an ongoing journey. So the moment we think we've arrived, like, yes, celebrate the arrival. There's a new discovery. There's something that we've achieved in terms of some fuller sense of self. And yet, life circumstances, new things, changes will inevitably call us to leave that, like to not get too comfortable, to not settle, because there's more of us, as you said, peeling back the layers of the onion, there's more of us to be discovered. So that's one of the things I think about when I think of wholeness. It is an ongoing journey. So there's that. But also, wholeness, it is not. It's important to remember this is, we're not talking about perfection here. In fact, for me, that was one of the things I needed to leave behind was, the three-headed monster I was battling was like my achievement orientation, perfectionism, and the ways that I was always performing to please other people, okay? As if those things would earn me love. Now, in my journey, so specifically come back to perfection, leaving that behind, wholeness, actually, what I think one of the core aspects is at the end of the day, it's not a it's not perfection. It's actually acknowledging our brokenness and acknowledging that at times we have been fragmented. It's acknowledging all the different parts of who we are, and that there have been seasons in our life where certain versions of ourselves, there were ways we had to show up to protect ourselves, to keep us safe. Like those three things for me, the achievement, perfectionism, performing to please, there's a reason I adopted those personalities. They helped me fit in, say, in my family or in culture or in my religious tradition. But at some point, these masks that we wear, these patterns that we've been operating with, they no longer serve us. So we have to leave them behind. Wholeness, when we quote unquote attain wholeness, what that means is we've come to terms with those other versions of ourselves. We're not just judging them and pushing them away. We're not just trying to cast them out into the shadows. We're seeing them, we're acknowledging them. There's a sense that we're even grateful for those parts of ourselves. And yet we're aware that in order to move forward, to become more free, those things can't rule the day for us. There's some upgrades that need to happen. Those things are expired. So we need to open ourselves to a newer, fuller version of who we really are. There's a lot more I'd like to say about wholeness, but I think that's sort of a starting point, because I think you're right to capture the fact that this isn't something, we're not talking about like a static state.
No.
And it is hard to know, like even in your body, what does that feel like? But maybe the last image I'll leave us with is just this sense of it's an at-homeness in yourself. It amidst the challenges and the difficulty and the suffering, that you can come back to that still small voice within you, that part of you that cannot be taken away no matter the drama that's going on around you. That's wholeness.
I love the way you've described that. And I love the way that you were very clear about this is not a static state. Because I think often our language can make us feel like we're trying to attain something. And when we get there, then, it's going to be with us for the rest of time. And often, it is like the spiral that you're talking about. I think in developmental terms, that feels very resonant to me. Now, your book talks about middle life, and this is often seen as a time of crisis. I mean, we talk about the midlife crisis, a time of change. And so I just wonder how you define midlife and what are some of the common challenges and opportunities that perhaps you talk about people facing during this period? Because again, this midlife space, it's an interesting thing, isn't it? Like we all go through it, and yet we've all got some idea of how it's gonna hit us. Do you know what I mean?
Oh, absolutely. So I absolutely get it. We tend to go to thinking about midlife as an age range. And I would say that's one helpful way of thinking about it. And maybe we say it's like what, 35 to what, 65, and maybe it's or 55, give or take 5, 10 years on each end. And then even that's up for debate. Now, if we look at it that way, then it's like, well, okay, this isn't relevant to me until I'm at that point. Or okay, now what? I'm in this season. What does it mean? Do I need to start forcing myself to ask these deep questions about who I am? Okay. I like to think, instead of just as an age range, think about it as a stage of life, which actually means it could happen any point. Side note, the fact that at midlife is included in the title, that was sort of debated internally at my publisher. So I could take or leave it. But I want to, invite people to consider midlife, since it's something that's in our kind of cultural conversation. Midlife is really, it's a hinge point. It's a transition point between who you were and who you're becoming. And it's this idea that folks like Carl Jung and Father Richard Rohr later talk about, these two halves of life. The first half of life, you're kind of building this sense, this secure, solid identity, and then something happens that disrupts that, and you're called out of that, and there's sort of the container that once defined you is sort of shattered or disrupted, and you have to figure out who is this more expansive version of self. So, with that in mind, coming back to the term midlife crisis, I think there's people who have researched it. Is it actually a thing? And the stereotypical things like you have an affair, you go buy a sports car, like whatever, that kind of thing. Well, whatever. People can debate this. What I think, even if that's a caricature, the truth of this idea of a midlife crisis, maybe this sense of I got to go find myself, things aren't working, it has to do with what I think is interesting, especially with this idea of the hero's journey, is like, what if we talk about a midlife call to adventure? That at midlife, like something rises in us. We've accumulated enough experience. And so some people, that experience, they might have accumulated enough in their early 20s, just like certain degree of pain and loss and suffering or challenges. For others, more typically, it might be a little bit later, but you've accumulated enough life experience, and that deep part of yourself, your soul, is like, something isn't working anymore. There's got to be more. There's another way. And it sees this season of life as a time to try to get your attention. If you refuse that call to adventure, which is what I experienced on that morning, that was a call to adventure. If you don't have your heart, you have nothing. And it can come in all sorts of different ways, quieter ways and loud ways. But if we refuse that, then I think what ends up happening is it starts to come out sideways, because we're not stepping into it now. We're not being receptive. We're not submitting to a process of transformation and growth. Instead, we're trying to force our way past it or through it. And what I mean by coming out sideways is it's this untended to thing taking place within us. We start kind of wreaking havoc on our relationships, or maybe our work, or making other decisions on the surface of our life because we're trying to ignore that deeper thing. And so ultimately, all the chaos maybe we create on the surface in our midlife crisis, for many people, that does then lead to that more, that reevaluation and confrontation, or you could say contending with these different parts of the self. I'll kind of stop there, but that's where my mind goes when I think about these ideas of midlife and midlife crisis.
Yeah, and I know from, studying Jung's work that he talks about it as like a place where you get to like a threshold of change, like an emotional maturity, more than a, I mean, he does link
Yes.
the age range, but I really get that. But there's something coming up for me, which is, and it's something I've had a lot of audience members when I've been speaking on a stage somewhere have come up and asked me afterwards. And one thing you don't know about me, Ben, is I came through a terminal diagnosis back in the early 2000s and kind of ignored kind of the mainstream medical advice and built my own what was thought of back then as fringe medicine people to help me try and find a different end to my story. I was meant to die by 2011. And I'm telling you this because it's part of what I share when I'm on stage. And this kind of what one of the things that, and it was also the thing, it was a major spiritual awakening for me. Not that I wasn't already on a spiritual path, I was, but it was major for me, this. And in many ways, it started me on a very different track with my work into this sacred changemaker space. And I've had audience members say to me, does this mean, like, I've never had any trauma like that. Does this mean I can't do this deep work? Like, does it always need to be catalyzed by some moment in life where we suddenly wake up? Or can it be more of a, oh, I'm going to choose to do this? I wondered what you'd say about that. Because of course yours isn't a terminal diagnosis, but it felt like every day there was still at the, when you had that moment, it was still pivotal in some way. It kind of pierced through the illusion. Sometimes I call it the matrix of life that we all live in. It kind of pierced through and then you turned it into a force for good. Somebody else might have just stayed in bed all day and not got up and needed depression medication. So, I mean, do you have a sense of what I'm kind of leaning into?
Because
I'd love to to speak to that and the audience to hear your perspective.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that part of your story too. That's really inspiring too, how you navigated that terrain and how you experienced an awakening in it as well, which is common when we're confronted with our mortality. And you are very directly, right?
Yeah.
So this is one of the reasons I wrote this book, is because in our world, in our culture, we love to celebrate like all the stories of like dramatic, everything collapsing and falling apart. So whether that is a near-death experience, whether that's, battling a disease, or whether it's, doing something, dealing with addiction or like financial ruin or destroying a relationship. We love the stories, like kind of everything being like collapsing, falling apart, but then like the phoenix rising from the ashes, this person like, comes into this new life. That's what, that sells a lot of books, and it's because it's captivating, and that's what we tell, there's a lot of movies about that, even if they're like biographies or whatever. The reason I wrote this book is to say, look, like you don't have to hit rock bottom. You don't have to have like this dramatic wake up call to realize that, there's more for you in life, that like maybe in some small ways you've become estranged from yourself, from your heart, and that don't wait around for everything to go bad before you begin this journey towards reclaiming your one, as Mary Oliver says, wild and precious life. You only have one. So I really see my journey, even though, you know, in my book, I talk a lot about quote unquote mystical experience or, you know, encounter, sacred encounters or mm-hmm. something. You might just say it's serendipity or maybe it's signs, like however people want to talk about that. You know, I did have I would describe that as like, it was a mystical experience of sort, like this inner voice, you know, but even if it was just something weird I ate the night before, who really cares? Like I paid attention to that moment. Because why not? Why not pay attention to these moments, even if they feel really foolish? What if they have to teach us something? And so this set me on a path of, you know, deeper and deeper transformation. But it's really important. It's like this journey is for everyday people.
Yeah.
You know, it's no matter the volume of your own pain and suffering, like we've all had pain. And so we've all got some stuff that we've got to deal with from our past. And if we don't deal with it, we're going to pass that pain on to others. And so by beginning to face those things, even if everything on the surface of our life appears to be just fine, like inevitably what will happen is we're going to hear a simple call and maybe another invitation to just like shed another layer, to take another step. And when we begin, we don't have the whole path charted out. You don't. But you will just know that maybe here's the next thing. And it might actually seem at the very beginning like you're just making a small choice because you want your relationship to have a bit more vitality in it, or you want to feel a greater sense of meaning in your work. But before you know it, after a year or two, suddenly you realize you've been on this epic inner quest that is beginning to change all these things on the surface of your life. It's a bit of a long answer, but to answer those folks who talk to you after you speak and whatnot, well, you know, you don't have to wait around for a diagnosis. You don't need to have made some horrible mistakes that you're trying to redeem. You can begin in any everyday moment. You can begin this journey of reclaiming your own heart.
Ben, I just had an insight as you were talking that I want to share, because I'm like, wow, what's this? So as you were talking there, you said about like shedding, right? And so I was like, yeah. And I'm thinking, actually, in my later years, my development has been more about releasing, letting go, shedding. And then I went to my early years where I was very much on a learning journey. And I'm like, that was about bringing stuff in and learning and adding to who I was becoming. What if middle life is the point at which you realize you've got enough?
Yeah.
It's not that you won't learn anymore there, but now your development is more about like letting go of the stuff that's no longer supporting and serving you, and more about kind of coming into truth, because that's what it feels like to me.
that's a beautiful image. And I think that's spot on. There's something very natural about there being a phase in our life. Like another way of talking about it is that first phase is like the ego is kind of in charge. I don't know, just like the ego gets a bad rap, but this is like the ego is that part of ourselves that helps us make our way in the world. It helps navigate things, and it like it sends the email and makes it so we can have a podcast conversation. It does all these things. But you know, I'm not going to go down that road so much, but it's to say like we're developing this container so we have this solid sense of self in the world. We identify ourselves in relationship to other things. But yes, as you said, there's a point where it's like we realize maybe we've accumulated too much. We've built up some things that actually have become, they don't serve us anymore. They're irrelevant. And so this is where, yes, this journey, it's like jettisoning some things. We're shedding. We're saying this is actually just going to sink me. Like to continue on the journey, it is this the path, the way is letting go. And one way to think of that, and a lot of this is, I interact with some of the work of Bill Plotkin in my book. He's like a therapist, ecologist, et cetera, or an ecotherapist. But, you know, he would say we move from this egocentric life to this soul-centric. And so we could think of the second half of life as it is more soul-centric, which when we're living in alignment with our soul, with our heart, lots of ways of talking about this, we are going to, our allegiance is to that inner truth, that inner thing. And we will realize that a lot of the stuff we've built up or we've added on, yeah, it doesn't serve that purpose. So that, and it doesn't mean we're getting rid of ego, it just means the ego ends up being in service to soul. So that deepest purpose and that sense of meaning, that's what guides us. Instead of, as what happened to me, is it got to a point where it's like my soul had been suppressed in service of continuing this ambitious building of things on the, the surface of my life.
And not only are you kind of creating this body of work that is so valuable for the ordinary person, but you're also taking it into different contexts. Now, teaching meditation in prison, to me, that's a unique and a profound, very human service. And I wonder if you can share some insights and experience from your time working with inmates and maybe even the impact that meditation has had on their lives.
Yeah, so this has been something that I've been up to for the last half year, so it's quite fresh. I have another course tomorrow in prison. It's a 4-session course teaching at state prisons here in Wisconsin. This work was really inspired by, so I've been teaching meditation for about 5 years, but when I moved from the Pacific Northwest to Wisconsin back to where I'm from, my mom who lives here, she's been an advocate and supporter of something called it's a restorative justice initiative that takes place through Marquette Law School here in town. And restorative justice, just for those who aren't familiar, it's a particular type of, in this case, is bringing together victims and perpetrators of violent crimes and law enforcement and judicial officials and community members, and using really the indigenous practice of gathering in a circle. This is a time for healing, for conversation, for storytelling, for reconciliation, rather than, what we tend to see in our court system, which, yes, there's an important role that has to play, but rather than just kind of the punitive model that doesn't always lead to bringing healing, right? So my mom introduced me to this thing, and I got connected to the woman who started it. Janine Geske's her name. And before, initially I was just like helping out students who are in the restorative justice program. Like I'd go give a talk or whatever on well-being and mindfulness, and this idea of being someone who's a change maker, and how do you do that in a sustainable way, as we were talking about earlier on in this conversation. And suddenly I was like feeling drawn to, honestly, I was feeling like other doors were closing in terms of receptivity to learning meditation. And so you know where the doors open? The doors are opening in the prison. And so I've really felt called into that space. I have some stories, like in my history of a few, no personal experience of being incarcerated, but some other experiences of like, oh, some seeds have been planted that I would be drawn to this or feel called to. And so my first group, there were 10 men in the group. And it was amazing to hear everything from, one of the participants saying, there's one reason I do this. There's only one reason, and it's just to get out of my cell when I'm in my cell. He's like, I got a good cellie, his bunk mate there. He's like, so it's not about him. He's like, but I just need to get out of here. I need space. And so literally he's sitting in there, his cellmate will be right there, and he's meditating, and he's, what he's doing is he's transcending, he's tapping into that bigger self. So if that is, giving that sense of freedom and spaciousness and in solitude is something that they can get out of it, I'll keep doing it for that. But then, there's the other stories are, we're talking a high stress environment, we're talking a lot of drama, emotionally distressful, all sorts of interactions and conflicts on a daily basis many times. But to hear things like, because really at the end of the day, this is about, I think meditation fundamentally is about not becoming a great meditator, but it's about enhancing your experience in your eyes open state. So it's not about what's happening when your eyes are closed, it's about how you live more fully. But to
Right.
hear back countless reports of like, oh, I was in line waiting to use the microwave, some guy jumped me, meaning cut in front of him, and typically I would like, fly off my handle. Like I would just lose it. Why? Because I got to keep up this sense of toughness. Instead, I'm like, oh, it's okay. Right. So, on a daily basis now, no longer accumulating more stress and trauma because of all these intense interactions, we're not only releasing stress, but we're we're accumulating less and less, which then, I'm just, as the path continues for so many of these men, excited to see how this will benefit them. Obviously, as they continue to be behind bars, but for many of them, when they get out, and there's studies from other meditation programs in prison that demonstrate that meditation can lead to reduced recidivism, which is an end goal here, is to say, in the state of Wisconsin where I live, within 3 years, it's something like 40 to 50% of individuals, formerly incarcerated individuals, are back in prison. So let's do something about that. And if we have this, we can cultivate this simple daily practice that has all these positive benefits. A lot of these studies show it's gonna impact those numbers. And that's what I want to see, how to help these men and eventually women too return back to their communities, which, by the way, this is good for all of us then, right? Like, this isn't just someone else's problem. Like, there's a cost financially that we pay for incarcerating individuals, but then if they're returning and they're more likely to be repeat offenders of crimes, like, that's not safe for our communities. So this thing at the end of the day that might feel like it's just for these individuals, it has this incredible ripple effect in their own lives and their families and in our communities. I could keep talking. I'm really excited about this, and really honored and humbled that I get to do this. It's so needed in that context.
No, I can certainly hear as you're speaking how passionate you are about bringing this work into this context. And I wonder about, I don't really know how to express this, but it seems to me that you bringing this work here, there's a huge ripple effect that benefits all of society, not just the individuals you're working with, but maybe for a number of them, it's the first time in their life that they've realized they're not just the criminal. There's something else. There's something more within that
That
could potentially define them. Do you see what I mean?
yeah
It's like,
oh oh this is something we talk about. So you just said there's something more within. So it's called the Within Project is the name of this. That's very deliberate, because yeah, it is, it's this whole, you're defined, especially if you are someone who's been incarcerated. This comes with you. This is an identity that society wants to, you cannot escape it. And then society wants to remind you of it all the time. So to have access, this is part of what we talk about. Like, this is why it takes 4 sessions. You're learning something very simple, but part of it is unpacking even the philosophy and, like, just understanding what this actually means and what you might experience as you continue to practice. But to come home to this the deepest, truest part of who you are, which, by the way, when you access that layer of who you are, it's also this sense of interconnectedness with every human and all beings, this fundamental sense of oneness. But that is a place of absolute dignity, of love, of light, of power. And you are so much more than the worst day of your life or the worst thing you've ever done. And in those settings, those folks are always reminded of the worst thing they've done, the worst day of their lives. In your daily life, like, how often, Jane, does someone tell you to tell them the worst thing you've done, or try to remind you that you are the worst thing you've ever done? This is not how we live as humans. So that whole system, it's like it's trying to keep people small in that sense. Now, here, through a practice, it's not about them believing there's something more. This is an amazing thing, and you know this as a meditator. It's not like, oh, we're just going to think our way into new reality. No, you are going to sense it at the deepest level. By dedicating yourself to this practice, you are going to discover that stillness within, which is this bountiful place of love, of belonging, of all the good things.
So, as a former ordained minister, how do you integrate kind of spiritual principles into your coaching and teaching? And I suppose I should say I'm making an assumption there. Do you?
Well, this is a great. At the beginning of our conversation, part of what I talked about was, like, that there's a continuity between these different phases of my calling. There's also discontinuity. So yes, I was an ordained minister, a pastor. I started a church in Seattle in 2007. And I was there about 10 years. And then I continued on in that realm, like coaching, supporting other leaders. But eventually, in about 2020, I like gave up my ordination status. Okay. Which, by the way, that ordination status is, it's like the official stamp of approval from a denominational, from an organization. And also I have my master divinity degree, but that was never the thing that validated what I did. Okay. I'll just say that, like, for me, and I think this is true, especially in an age where, like, look, credentials and going through things are important, especially in our kind of coaching world that's a little insane right now. But at the end of the day, the thing that is the truest sign of your credibility is, like, I mean, is that sense of inner awareness and sense of self-knowledge and sense of calling, and then the ways that people, that you treat people, and how they, you know, like, will trust you. So there's a lot more I could say about that, but I essentially got to a point where I realized that that version of being someone, and this is the line of continuity, but I was, oh, someone dedicated to, like, cultivate, like, spirituality, inner life, and community and belonging, and social healing or social transformation. That was expressed in this ordained minister role, and yet that container didn't work anymore. So that those core things, the continuity is that I'm still doing those things now, but now the expression is different, right? And it's almost like I'm wearing a few more hats now. It's like I'm not just pastor, but I'm doing very pastoral things. I'm constantly helping people tune into their inner lives. I provide hospice care as a chaplain. I'm, you know, teaching meditation. I do coaching. These are all words, but at the end of the day, these are all vehicles for me expressing this inner sense of calling to help nurture people's inner lives and empower them to carry out and fulfill their purpose in the world, the thing that they're called to. I think in terms of spirituality specifically, right, there's lots of ways we can define that. Let's not go with I don't. Let's say this. I was in a particular arena for that in terms of being a Christian minister. So the stories you tell, the resources you draw upon, it's like, let's say it's one shelf in the library, and it's a powerful shelf, and the books there are incredible, and it's filled with wisdom. But now, and this part of my own journey that even preceded being in a pastoral role, I feel like, and this is comes through in my writing, but I'm constantly interacting with all the great spiritual traditions and the wisdom that comes from them. And I feel very free in terms of carrying these things forward, these teachings, not in a way that's about, and this never really defined me as a pastor, but it's not about believing this or that. It's about coming to know these truths from your own inner experience. So in one sense, I'd say spirituality, this shapes every, this is like involved in everything I do. And at the same time, it's kind of, it's not spiritual in the sense that it's not religious in the same way. Or you could say it's inner religious and inner spiritual. So depending on the moment you get me, I might answer that question differently than I did right now, but that's where I'm at today.
I love it. Now, you sent me a beautiful quote before, as we were getting ready for our recording today, and it was from Mother Teresa. And it says, "If we have no peace, it's because we have forgotten we belong to each other." How does that play a part in your work, Ben?
Yeah. I, speaking of continuity, discontinuity, I'd say the younger version of myself, and bless him, ambitious and ambitious in starting, like, really, like, good, beautiful things, but also, yeah, lost that sense of connectedness with himself. But the theory of change, okay, so we're talking sacred change makers. I would say my previous theory of change, and it will probably change many times in my life, but was really about, I want to change the world through, like, at a societal level, at a communal level. So two things: one, there being the systems, that's really important. This was behind some of our work in terms of the community center that we started in Seattle, which is still thriving and doing incredible work. But also at communal level. So the church I started, it wasn't like, hey, we're all driving into this big event on Sunday. I mean, we were like a very organic, small, I mean, at our biggest, for like 150 people, kids included, but like we lived in a neighborhood. The overwhelming majority of us lived in like a 10 by 10 block radius, and we took very seriously the well-being of that community, all members, not just those who could afford to live in houses and maybe had nice jobs working at Amazon downtown, but those who lived in rundown motels on the side streets and those who lived in their vehicles and these kinds of things. So, look, powerful change did come through. Now, in part because of my own experience, like of burning out and maybe not functioning at my out of my best self at times, this has led to what I would say now my theory of change is I feel called to begin with the individual. So like I'm going into prisons right now and I'm helping these people access their true self, that core essential self through meditation so that can grow out of them and they can be healed and be a healing presence in the world. This is another alternative could be I could go like I imagine I will, like I'm already getting networked with these other groups, but I could be someone who's saying there's a place for these, but like, let's change the system or let's end incarceration, like all these things. I think that's really valid and important. That's not what I feel called to right now. I feel called to start with the individual. Does that make sense what I'm saying there?
It really does. Yeah.
Okay. And just to kind of bring that back to this Mother Teresa quote is, this idea of we've forgotten that we belong to one another. There's ways to in that work of community building, it's powerful to paint alternative picture, to paint a picture of what it looks like to belong. Okay. I think I'm not necessarily doing that at a communal level right now. I think that's something we can do through teaching individuals practices like inner practices. So we can remember that we belong to one another by remembering who we truly are, which is how do we, by remembering who we truly are, coming back to something I said earlier, we are remembering that isn't it just an individual statement. It is this sense of interconnectedness and oneness that, you know, that fundamental belonging to each other as the human family is something we can touch upon in these moments of stillness. So if we can be a part of that, we're accessing it at a deep level, not at a like a head or intellectual level. We're accessing it at a level of inner knowing, which then I think has a ripple effect from the individual into communities, into society, etc. So that's where I'm at right now in my theory of change.
Well, I would agree with you. And I really want to thank you for the way you answered that, because one of the things I've often wondered as I get, you know, beyond three decades in human change, is this idea that if you don't belong to yourself, using Mother Teresa's parroting Mother Teresa here, then there's no way for you to really feel like you belong, we belong to each other. And one of the conversations we have a lot here at Sacred Changemakers is this journey from me to we. And if the me's not in place, I'm noticing time and time again that, you know, sometimes it feels to me like that quote could be the crux of many of the problems that we're facing in the world today. Yeah. And one of the things that I've given voice to before on this podcast, and I'll say it again here, is we, you know, I do believe we have a lot of leaders or people in positions of power that are kind of running from unhealed stories in a way. And so I'm totally with you. And I know a lot of our audience will also agree with your perspective here. But it's interesting because, like you, it's taken me like to get through the ego work and wanting to change the world to coming back to, well, let's just do this in a more organic way and work with individuals in their lives and then trust that the ripple effect goes out, because I actually believe it does. In fact, I think it's probably the only way we can change in any sustainable or regenerative way.
Yeah, I agree.
So you have also chosen another context for your work more recently, Ben, which is as a hospice companion. Now, this must offer really deep insights into not only death and the end of life process, but also life itself in a way. And I just wonder what took you to that place and what you're noticing.
Yeah.
You know, 'cause I'm sure this will shift your perspective in some ways too.
Yeah. I began volunteering as a hospice companion about 18 months ago, and then just a few weeks ago I officially started as a chaplain, so part-time, so because I want to do more of this. The reason I got into it would be because I had emerged from, and this is much of what I write about in The Way Home, but you know, this 5-6 year inner journey, this soul
right.
quest. And in that, one of the core aspects is, which we touched upon briefly earlier, but it is a critical step, is to face your own death, to face your mortality. And I mean that in two ways. One is literally your inevitable future death. Like, this is,
right.
By the way, it's like the death rate for human beings is 100%. We're all going to die, right? So this is a part, this comes up in all the spiritual teachings. This is the core aspect, okay? So there's that literal part. There's also the kind of the figurative part, which is to say, as we've been talking about, whether it's shedding, right? Like, these different images, but they're about leaving behind, letting go, shedding a former version of ourselves. That is a death also. It's a death of something that's no longer serving us. So I had died to former versions of myself, right? And also was contending with the fact that eventually I will die. So it was coming through that I was like, wow, I think that I feel prepared and called to just be in this space where, I mean, getting a glimpse into the system, I mean, so often people in, like, seniors in general, but the closer people get to, like, the end of their lives, they're just, like, isolated and on their own. I mean, the overwhelming majority of people die in different senior care facilities, okay, versus, like, dying at home. And also knowing from experiences and just seeing things, like, often in these times, what happens is, because we're caring so much, as we're losing a loved one, we might show up in ways, it's like it becomes a lot about us. And I want to say that's natural. But what it means is we're not alongside the person who's dying to allow them to die in the way that they want to die. And so they end up, the person who's dying is like trying to care for, you know, is even sticking around because they're trying to care for their loved ones. So part of stepping into this space is, it's honestly, it's about helping me become even more acquainted and comfortable with my eventual death, but also the death of loved ones around me. But it's also to be that person who can be in that, stand in that gap and be a supportive presence to accompany the dying and ensure that they are having, you know, the kind of experience that they want. They're having space to reflect on the things they want to. It's also to come alongside the grieving, who are reacting and responding to this in all sorts of different ways. So, you know, 18 months is not that long. And so in terms of having been in this, so I acknowledge there's so many people who've been at this, and especially thinking of nurses, for example, who are in these settings, who do so much. And you think of during the time of COVID, how dramatic that the impact that had, especially on senior care facilities. So I feel like I'm just at the beginning, but I can tell you this, that it's a really sacred space to be in. And I'm grateful for the opportunity to be there.
And as you were speaking there, I was noticing kind of the integration in your work between the inner kind of life and inner journey and also outer mission to create meaningful impact. And I could hear that as you were talking about, you know, like the grieving family members and then the inner journey with the reflection of the person that is dying. And it's like, wow. So I just wonder, you know, this is a conversation that we talk about a lot in Sacred Changemakers, is this, and a lot of our community are seeking these changes to reimagine business and leadership. Quite a lot of them are in that space. So I just wonder if you had any advice on helping them integrate their own inner journeys with their outer missions to create meaningful impact in the world.
Such a big question.
I know.
Big, beautiful
You're
question.
You're ready for it, though, Ben.
Yeah. You know, I think that I'll speak from my experience, and this is one of the things, again, I reflect on in The Way Home, the book, which is also a part, by the way, of my understanding of wholeness. But at the end of the day, The most important thing I believe we all can do is access that true self, that inner, another way to talk about it is the stillness within. It's like the layer beneath the layer beneath the layer, like of all the things that are changing and moving and are dynamic, there's this calm, steady stillness. And again, all the traditions speak about this as well, but in my mind, stillness, to then function out of a place of stillness is to move through the world out of a deep place of integration. So, and alignment. To access stillness means, I like to talk about stillness as the centered place between squandering and striving. I spent a lot of my life striving. Okay, by that I mean striving is to like look ahead to the future. It's to like be grasping for something ahead. It pulls you out of the present. It's you're often discontent because you want something more. That's what striving does. And it can separate you from that core self, from the inner stillness. Squandering, on the other hand, is an issue for many of us as well. Squandering would be like trying to cling to the past, to some former version of who you were or some golden era of your life, as if like that's it, that's the best. And if it fell apart, then like you live with a lot of regret and anger. Squandering is really like it buries treasure instead of like carrying forth what you've been given. It's like you're like, forget it, because you're afraid maybe things won't work out again. So stillness is like it's the center place between those. It is not a place of inactivity. In fact, it's a place of profound activity, but it's the activity flows out of that inner knowing, that self-awareness, that presence, so that the things you end up doing, the choices you make in your business, in your vocation, it's coming out of that place, not which is to say it's resonant with your internal world, your internal knowing, not coming out of some based on some external reference point. That doesn't mean you're not incorporating data and expertise and knowledge from all sorts of disciplines and whatnot, but it just means you're not letting our very much ego-driven society. You were talking about how so many of our leaders, right? They're functioning out of that place of their own untended wounds, essentially. But you're not like letting that guide you. You are letting this inner knowing guide you. So I don't know if that precisely answers like what you're asking, but to me, I think that's one of the most critical qualities for any leader, to be attuned with that inner self so that they can then express it in, through all the different aspects of their life.
Yeah, I love that. I do. Ben, I'm noticing the time, so I'm just going to give you our final question for today, because this has been such a rich conversation. But if there's something you'd hoped we'd get to today, or maybe it's just something you want to share with our listeners, maybe a few words of wisdom, what might it be?
I'm going to go inward for a second. I want to I again acknowledge that a lot of this can at times sound really lofty and out there. And so to break it down into its simplest form is what we're getting at here throughout this whole conversation is not it's an ongoing journey, and it's going to last a lifetime. But the way to begin it is in a moment. And that moment does not have to, again, it doesn't have to be some sabbatical that stretches over months or some trip around the world or even like an hour a day meditating or something like that. It's, but what can you do today to make space to listen to your life or to listen to that inner voice or to open yourself up to the stillness that is already within you, but maybe you've become disconnected from. So start small, but start today.
Lovely. Ben, thank you so much for your time today. I have thoroughly enjoyed our conversation. I know our change makers will have got so many insights. So thank you, my friend.
Jane, thank you so much for your curiosity and questions.
Okay, guys, that's all we have time for today. Thank you so much for listening in. Now, before we go, I want to remind you that all of the resources and the links for our guests are in the show notes at sacredchangemakers.com. A big thank you to the members of the Sacred Changemakers Inner Circle, who are our podcast sponsors, and also our extended community, who are helping us to make a global impact aligned with the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals, all visible on our website. And if you're looking for more soul in your life and business, if you have a sense that you too have a calling, maybe you're here to make a bigger impact or just simply connect with others on your change-making journey. If our episode resonated with you today, I hope you'll consider joining us. Again, you can find out more at sacredchangemakers.com. But for now, I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for your intention and efforts to make our world a better place. Until next time, lots of love.